Hi, I'm Tom from Chicago. The Sound of Young America is a completely independent production supported by contributions from listeners like you and me. If you'd like to support the show, please visit MaximumFun.org.
I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart, and this is The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org. Welcome to The Sound of Young America. Our guest on this program is rock and roll star Andrew W.K. Before we start the interview, let's hear some music from Andrew's most recent record, Close Calls with Brick Walls.
Are you ready?
This is The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. You know, there are a few people who have been on The Sound of Young America many times because we like them particularly much, and my guest today is one of those people. Rock and roll star Andrew W.K. Is the creator of three albums of music which somehow managed to meld the intensity of hardcore punk rock with the spirit of unbridled fun. His most recent is Close Calls with Brick Walls, and he'll be appearing at the People's Improv Theater in New York City on the 13th of February to conduct a sort of question and answer lecture. Andrew, welcome back to The Sound of Young America.
Thank you so much, Jesse. This is one of my favorite destinations in radio land, if that's the proper location.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll buy radio land. I like that.
It's one of the first domains of non-physical human interaction.
Exactly. I would consider it primary. I think that most people, if they're not talking to somebody directly, they're in radio land.
Yeah, maybe that's the maybe anything that isn't face-to-face is radio land.
So I want to ask you about your new record. Your new album, which was not released in the United States, Close Calls with Brick Walls.
Yes.
The title is one that is very evocative, and I wonder if you chose that name because of some kind of sort of personal experience that you had or to describe in some way your own journey.
Well, first of all, thank you for asking about that album. And I would like to explain, because many people have asked me, and I would like to be clear that while the album has so far exclusively been released in Asia, in South Korea and Japan, to be exact, there are, just as of a few days ago, plans to now release a special vinyl edition in the U.S. this year. And the plan was always to release the album everywhere, but not immediately. So we're still keeping with that plan, and the special vinyl edition is going to keep the plans of the CD edition not coming out until later. But this will be a very new and different version of the record that people here can get. You asked about the title, and the title Close Calls with Brick Walls is I now think a neat paradox in itself, in that the other titles of the previous two albums I did, The Wolf, which was the second, and the first was I Get Wet. I remember thinking at the time of choosing those titles and speaking about them later to people that I felt those were not a personal reflection of an experience for me, other than the experience maybe of the album itself. But I was not trying to necessarily represent or express an experience I had with those titles, even with those lyrics. This album, the title Close Calls with Brick Walls, is specifically about addressing ideas that I had previously adhered to and trying to break out of them and trying to identify what have been my self-made brick walls, what rooms have I built for myself to operate in creatively, and how can I get around those walls? Because a lot of times I didn't even realize I was building walls, and so it felt almost like the room was closing in. Maybe a good comparison would be in Star Wars, when those garbage compactor walls start pressing in. And I felt like without maybe seeing it, I was at the last second before perhaps a prison-like cell of brick walls was about to close around me of my own creation, and then I had a chance to escape. And a very interesting example of escaping one of those walls was the wall of having titles that didn't express something personally. And so this one does express something personally, and that in itself was perhaps the first step to name it that title and to then use that title as a creative headspace in its own right.
One of the things that I was struck by that title was, obviously, your performances and your music are marked by kind of astonishing intensity. And the idea of Close Calls with Brick Walls suggested to me, you know, maybe it's just because I've been playing a lot of Grand Theft Auto lately, and you drive really fast on the motorcycle and then you run into something and fall off. But it suggested to me like that kind of fear that when you are moving that fast, hitting something can be really catastrophic.
Yeah. That's the close call side of it, I suppose. When you're living an intense life, I think that's when the potential for those collisions becomes very high. And of course, that's what engages others to witness the obstacle course, and is this person going to make it through? Or maybe people are able to appreciate other things. Maybe they don't see the walls themselves. Maybe they're in walls of their own that keep them from seeing my walls for entertainment or not. But this was a chance, or the result on this album, were after having a chance to slow down.
You had done, I think it was more than 300 shows in 2 years, basically starting with the release of your first LP and then moving through the release of The Wolf. You were on tour basically the entire time. In fact, I remember that one of the more recent times that you were on this show, I talked to you and you were living out of a hotel room basically because it didn't make sense for you to have an actual house.
That's right. I remember that interview. That was in the Roger Smith Hotel in Manhattan, in New York City. I was living there for about a month and a half, or maybe it was 2 months, while I filmed a MTV show here. It was, as you pointed out, my place of living, because I had no other place of my own, by my own choice. There was no reason to have a house, as you said. But it was during my stay at that hotel, and not long after we spoke on the station, that I had decided to get a house of my own in New York. And it was really inspired by that stay in the hotel room.
Was there some experience that you had around then that led you to kind of take a step out of that headlong rush and do the reevaluating that you just described?
It's very interesting for me to have you ask that, because up until a couple of days ago, I would have said no, or that there it was a reverberation of many instances and choices that build up on themselves and then lead me to a new choice. And I may not have had the perspective at that moment, making the choice to move back there, to consider and be aware of all the other situations or experiences I had had prior that would have led me to that moment. So looking back now, I can do that. But at the time, there was just a sense of wanting to do something that I didn't feel like I should do. And that had always been a big strategy in making decisions, is what feels like the riskiest decision. Or if something appealed to me, a possibility like moving to a new place, the way I usually decided whether or not to go through with it was how bad of an idea it sort of seemed to me previously. And so at that time, it seemed like a really unnecessary thing to do. This is not the time to move. I've been fine without a house for 5 years now. Why would I, actually at that point it was four, so why would I want to get one now? But it seemed like the kind of excitement that I had thrived on all along was to change things up. And in my moments of intense effort and energy, sometimes a focus was taken away from that and put more on consistency, so that I was able to deliver the kind of energy into the performances, into the whole experience of following through on an original choice to go on tour or to make music that required a certain amount of time dedicated to the furthering of that music. And so a lot of my energy was put into that, and then I realized there were still other ways to apply that energy that would be just as productive, even if they seemed scary or sort of amorphous to me at that time, hard to pin down. But those kind of unknowns became more and more thrilling to me. And I can, looking back now, say that there was an experience that I had that was very, very particular, very strong, and very new. And it certainly informed every thought I've had since then, although I never would have felt comfortable talking about it so in a way that gives it so much power or so much importance. Now I feel more comfortable about talking about it. Should I say what it is?
Yeah, I think you should say what it is.
Okay. It was doing a certain legal drug that I had heard about for many years but never had done. And the name of the drug is salvia. I think the full name is Salvia divinorum, and it's also known as diviner's sage. And it's a legal herb that you can buy, I think, in every country except perhaps Denmark. There's one country that made it illegal. But it does appear to be relatively harmless in terms of side effects or any real serious impact, because the experience that you supposedly are meant to have is very brief, about 2 to 5 minutes long. In that way, it's been compared to a drug called DMT, which I've never taken, although I do have some in my possession right now, 5 feet away from me in a box, in a drawer. But I haven't taken that yet, and I haven't felt the need to, because this experience with this salvia, which happened in the Roger Smith Hotel, was so powerful.
What was it? What was your experience?
It was the evening. The sun had probably already set. It was winter. This was about this must have been almost 4 years ago. Three years ago. And I had gotten some of this in Japan. We had just come back from touring Japan for the Wolf album. And we had gone to a special store in Tokyo, I think, called Freak Brothers, which is named after the Gilbert Sheldon comic book, which I was always a huge supporter of and really liked that comic. So it was very appealing to go to the store that was a head shop, as much as there could be a head shop in Japan. But it was a very cool place. And I went there with Big Daddy, who's the stage manager for us, and I went with a friend of ours named Nick, who lives in Japan. And who else went? Paul, our sound manager, Paulie. And we were buying different things, and I noticed they had the salvia, and that's actually why we went there in the first place. And Paulie had bought some, so we took that back with us to the U.S. after trying a little bit of it in Japan and not really feeling much. And Jesse, I'll just do my best to sum up the story, but it's hard to really do it justice. Anyway, when I got back to New York, I still had some, and I had some friends over, and one of them, my friend Matt, had already done this before years ago and had a really, really intense experience, and that's how I had heard of it in the first place, was him telling me, oh my gosh, it was the most wild 2 minutes of my life. And so we all decided to do some, and we're in this hotel room, and I'm laying down on top of the bed, sort of propped up, because Matt said it was really important to be comfortable. His cousin showed up, my friend Spencer. He was sitting on the other side of the bed. Matt was sort of pacing around the room, and then my friend Mark was sitting in a chair. And Matt said, well, you smoke it out of this pipe, and probably after about 10 really strong, thick, full smoke-blown hits of this very acrid burning sage, you'll start to feel sort of a cold, clammy, numb, tingly feeling. And when you start to feel that, take the biggest draw off the pipe you possibly can, and then it should kick in. Sure enough, I started feeling a cold and clammy sensation on the bottom of my feet, which felt terrible. I said, well, this must be it. And I took this huge draw, and all I remember from that point on was sort of reaching my hand up to give the pipe to Matt, and then this huge sensation of, oh no, as in, what did I didn't think this is what it was going to be like, and then I felt paralyzed. And I don't even think I laid back down. I think I froze, and my all vision went, all sensory information that I had prior experiences with was gone. And what I was left with was an awareness of a very different level of sensory input that might not have even been coming through what you'd call senses. I understand that this can all now start to sound, you can make whatever you want of it from this point, but this is my best description. I felt like I was coming out of a coma, and coming out of a coma. Although I had never come out of one before, I'd come out of times when I went under to get my teeth pulled out, or certain times of getting very, very sick when I was young and I was delirious. But this was completely new for me. And laying on this bed, the physical space of the room, which I primarily was gauging and organizing in my mind, is the distance between major objects. So the distance between my point of view, my eyesight, and the post on the bed, or my eyesight and the television, or my sight and that wall. And all my sense of being able to gauge based on those distances was not just inhibited or undercut, but completely removed, as that all became solid. There was no sense of separation between objects, the space between two fixed objects and the out world, as they appear, the outside world, had become fused as one object that just had these aspects of what I used to think of distance in its design. But the so-called empty space in between the television and my foot was as solid as my foot and the rest of my body. And from there, it unfolded into a more complex version of that as I came out of this coma, until my senses were restored to their previous state, albeit with this experience under my belt. So from that point on, things felt different. I couldn't remember my name. I couldn't not only remember my name, I couldn't remember who I was. Not only that, in the deepest thicket of this bramble bush, I couldn't remember that I was anything. And that, of course, is pure oblivion, which is, as I understand it, what all of us are seeking, or whether we would like to seek it or not, to have complete removal, completely removed observance. And then I remembered that I did exist, and I remembered that, okay, well, I am one of many. I remember I was one of these things. I saw Matt's form in this room. I remembered, okay, well, he, my friend, he's someone, he's one of these things that I am too. And then it seemed for a few moments that I could have come back and been any person, not myself, not even someone that I was friends with. I could have been anybody, anywhere. It was like there were, and we've seen illustrations of this through the arts for decades, there were maybe 5 billion doorways into someone's reality. And any one of those doorways, which may have been randomly marked for me at that point, I could have opened and gone into someone else's body, someone else's existence, someone else's life. And again, as it was like coming out of a coma, I started to see my choices in this, what then seemed arbitrary life of Andrew. I started to see that how each one of my experiences played out and made me be what I was. So it was a very existential, as they'd say, realization of your ego, and that you are built by these series of choices or circumstances, some of them that seemed very far out of my control, or maybe that wasn't a choice at all, like having certain parents or living in a certain room when I was growing up. All those seemed like, oh no, these are those very particular things that make me me. And I was almost a little disappointed when I remembered that I was that, and I went back into it and then became myself again. But being able to have an awareness that was so focused yet so far removed clearly had a huge impact, and I never had considered these things before. And I think my whole life was an awakening to that moment and from that moment. And I don't feel like that empowers that moment with any great importance beyond it being interesting to talk about now. That's why I haven't really talked about it much. But I think any moment of focused, heightened awareness, it reverberates or emanates impact on what happened before it and happens after it, and it almost unfolds in all directions. And it really was fun.
You will remember tonight. You will remember tonight. When you remember your life, you will remember tonight. Today will be over and done, the sunrise. But the way that you feel,
did it change the choices that you were making?
Well, again, this is all, what's the word? It's recollection on one hand, but it's also revisiting these events and looking for meaning in them as to how they might apply to choices I've made now. And that's a unique position to be in itself, to consider what's already happened. So I can maybe try to form some kind of thread. I think there was a general sense that that perhaps it wasn't absurd or naive or ignorant or selfish to think that I had complete control over every aspect of my experience and my reality, and that things like outside circumstance or even the very idea of outside was just another choice I was making, to see things in that light. And that if I could just alter my habits enough, my habits of thought, and really focus on what it was like to think and trying to dissect all the layers of my thought and realizing also that all my experiences are being translated by my thoughts, or are perhaps the thoughts themselves are the experiences. And so when I meet somebody for the first time and I start to put together a picture of them, when I start to sum them up, I'm creating the idea of this person. I'm comparing their face to the blank universal face in my head, like Plato's universal chair, the definitive chair. I have a definitive person in my head that we're all comparing this face to. That's how we gauge the distances between the eyes and the nose. And then I'm examining their behavior and trying to build an idea of their character or not. But the information I'm taking is not naked fact outside of myself. It's my own ideas. If I say this person's awesome, that's still why someone else could say they're a jerk, because their version of what that person is in the story of their life is different. And I started thinking of it very clearly as with movies. I think this is a good example, just to sum this up, put this in a nutshell, which is kind of the whole point, is to not do that. But it's nice to be able to communicate these ideas. So if we think about a movie, which have been used and to illustrate this time and time again, very literally, and whether they do or not, in their physical story of the movie, a movie itself is a recreation of a reality, or a new reality being presented by different people's perspectives, or perhaps the director's perspective, for the viewer to experience on their own terms, and to really trick the mind into believing you're in a reality so that you can follow any kind of story at all. So if we think of our own lives as movies, and that we're the director of this movie, and we're the writer of this movie, and we're also the star of the movie, then when a character comes into the film, unless you're filming a documentary or you're just shooting on the street, if you're writing the story to be how you want it to be, when you bring a character in, you have written that character into the story. And your interpretation of that character's behavior comes from within you first, prior to that character's outside will to do their own thing, because they only exist in your head. So these experiences gave me reason to have the confidence to believe that my subjectivity or a solipsism, where everything that exists is only in your head, perhaps that's the way I want to think. And that's the easiest way to sum it up.
It sounds like it sounds kind of liberating. It sounds almost like...
Oh, yeah.
It sounds kind of like giving yourself permission to be yourself.
I'm glad you see it that way. I think that's a really great way to put it. It was liberating. It's liberating on one hand because you feel like you have unlimited power and unlimited freedom, and that any sensation that you experience, any range of emotion from happiness to sadness, any ability to say your life is good or bad, that these are all words and ideas and symbols for these physical experiences that defy our ability to communicate what exactly they mean. But we struggle with these symbols. And what if we're able to turn those symbols into, through focus, I suppose, or through discipline, or through sheer belief, through faith, which was a more recent struggle for me, was how to reconcile my problems I had with believing in anything at all, coming from a place where I decided there's nothing I can know. Knowledge is to know anything is false, is lying. I can have ideas about things, but I can't know. And then I thought, well, maybe that's what believing is for. When you don't know, you start to believe. And so on the one hand, there was a great sense of possibility, but there was also a huge sense of terror in the face of this unlimited possibility. And that you then doing an inventory backwards or projecting forwards, anything that happened to me that I had complained about, that I thought was bad, that I said was a mistake, that was a bad luck, was a circumstance that was unpleasant and unfortunate, that was all me all of a sudden. Why did I put myself in this situation if I'm going to take full responsibility? But this, nothing is scarier than realizing one's own unlimited potential. And that I think is infinitely more challenging than actually undergoing the steps or taking action to see through someone's own potential. The challenge, what confidence comes down to, I think, is not being confident to talk to people you're shy of, being confident to take a risk, being confident to do something you've never done before. That is confidence, but I've thought now more confidence is about having the gall or almost the nerve to believe in something that seems absurd if it will make you feel more like you want to feel.
I want to see you go wild.
It seems like, in a funny way, that's what a lot of your music is about. I think a lot of your sort of lyrical themes are, either kind of vague or things that people would sometimes consider to be silly, you know, like having fun or partying
exactly,
or whatever.
Right. Yes, yes.
But it seems like in part what you're trying to achieve by kind of having that sort of almost absurd simplicity of theme is kind of getting over the idea that somebody shouldn't do that because it's simple and
to really make your own decisions for your own self purely based on the emotions, on what the emotions being, well, there's feelings that feel good, there's feelings that feel bad. There's many shades of those feelings. There's even feelings that are somewhere in between or just on the tipping point in between good and bad, like melancholy could be that much closer to a good feeling. I've certainly experienced it that way. And then there's certain types of ways of being at peace or being comfortable that might not put you further so far over to good or bad. But if we just take away a sliding scale and just look at it as I feel good or I feel bad, having the confidence to trust your emotions in that way and follow them through. And music's this beautiful tool for causing or amplifying or creating emotions. It seems like it can create entirely new emotions that we've never felt, and that's why it can be so addicting. It seems like the physical sensations that happen through music are so similar to emotion, and we relate them to emotion, we relate them to experiences, but they are not the experiences. They're listening to music. Music is a whole range of emotions that are outside of human emotion, but that are of it. It's very exciting. And to me, the goal has been pretty consistently in all that we've talked about, how can I feel as good as possible? How can I feel, and not just the idea of good, having an experience where if I do a checklist of what's going on in the experience, oh, these are all good things, that I could still not be feeling good. And so how can I, first and foremost, really have this physical sensation that I've equated as being good, and how can I make other people aware of it and have them have it too? And the music talks about that in many ways, I think, and the purest sense, like you said, is to first and foremost have the confidence to say it's good and right for me to feel good and right all the time, all the time. And anything less than that is not the idea, is not the way the real world works, or is not the way that my real world is going to work. And that it's not hoping for too much or having too high standards to say, I'm going to figure out a way and continue to figure it out. And that way is going to be the way of pure happiness, pure love. And maybe my ideas about that will change as I go. But just to set that as the main focus in life seemed like as good a meaning for life as any.
That seems both a little bit scary and a little bit hard. And I'm thinking of it in reference to what we were talking about before. I mean, when you're talking about music, I think of, you know, the intensity of just the experience of being in the audience at one of your shows is, you know, I can only imagine what it's like to be putting out what you put out in one of your shows. And I must, like, literally my mind reels at the prospect of doing that, you know, four times in a week. How do you, if you have that, the question is, if you have that kind of limitless objective, if you have that kind of big, broad goal, how do you manage it, like, in terms of, you know, eating a sandwich or
that's a great question.
Just being day to day?
That's a fantastic question. How do we set a primary goal of being the greatest person that I can possibly be, or whatever we imagine is the biggest goal for ourselves? Someone could say it was a certain material object. Someone could say it's a certain type of experience in relationships. So it's whatever our number one pyramid top point of destination is. And ultimately, you should be there already and be there at all times. And that's how you get there, is just by being there. But how do you then segment up your reality so that you can still make choices based on a different outcome? I think it's realizing that you don't have to do it that way, for me, because back then everything did seem a lot harder. And it seemed like my mind was a pie cut up into many different pieces, a pie dedicated to physical energy and going to the gym and eating enough and making sure that I had lots of very physical performing energy. Then another pie piece was the music that we're playing and that I'm writing. Then another pie piece was talking with people and talking with people in the audience and doing this. And another pie piece was my family and friends from that I grew up with. Another pie piece was making new songs and making new music and being creative. Another pie piece, and then those pie pieces would be divided up. And that was how I really kept things organized in my head, or felt like I had a grasp on what I wanted to do. And I think it was a perfect thing to do at the time. But if someone had asked me, is this easy or hard, I would have just said it doesn't have anything to do with easy or hard. It's just going through steps. And that was what now I've tried to embrace entirely, that it's never a means to an end. The whole experience is an end. And if I've just decided that I've already, that whatever I do is based on this end, then it's just a constant part of it. So if the point of view is all influenced by, I'm focused on it, always feeling good and having joyful experiences, or that's my goal, then everything, including things that are not necessarily good feeling or joyful, become informed as part of that focus. And it makes eating the sandwich the greatest thing you've done all day, because you're so happy to eat the sandwich because you're in a state of joy. I can also see how people could take issue with this, and that the richness of life and the dynamic that's brought to life is through the range of experiences and sensations. And I say that it's in itself is a choice. And if you decide that going back and forth from happy to sad doesn't feel as good, then it's just a choice. There is no default experience. It's when someone would say, singing about partying, those are stupid songs, or that's a shallow topic. The only answer to that is that it's not even a criticism. That's their choice. I love that viewpoint. Of course I love that. That's a huge part of it, is to revel in the shallow waters and realize that by stepping in one direction of thought in either way, you can fall into infinitely deep waters within the same pool of party, within the same ocean of having fun. And that all these ideas of what is good or what is bad, or what we like and what we don't like, or what constitutes good music or bad music, or good or bad anything, are our own thoughts. And it became much, much more fun for me to find pleasure in all things than to contain my experiences in a constant set of judgments about whether they're good or bad or easy or hard or anything other than part of the main goal of feeling good or feeling whatever it is this is that it feels. Talk about not calling it good or bad. Yeah, it all contradicts itself, but I think that's a really important part of it that keeps it moving.
Well, Andrew, I guess this interview was one of our least goofy ever, but thank you for being on The Sound of Young America.
Thanks for asking me.
Andrew WK's most recent record is Close Calls with Brick Walls. It'll be released in the United States soon. He appears at Here's the Thing at the People's Improv Theater in New York City on February 13th at 8 p.m. He's online at andrewwk.com.
Whoever said that life would be easy never walked a mile in my shoes. Every day a desire awaits me. There was nothing else I could do but fight against all odds, against the deadly soul that's living in my heart. I won't give up, I won't give in.
That's the end of another Sound of Young America podcast. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our theme music was written and performed by Dan Grayson with help from myself. Listen, there's big things on the horizon for The Sound of Young America, some stuff I'm really excited to tell you about, but can't and won't yet. But I'm guessing maybe next week, so keep tuned in to The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org.